Okay, thanks, Hazel. My title's changed a bit as well. And I suppose in some respects it hasn't got anywhere near exhaustion, and feels like it's sort of like at the beginning of the trip of engaging with Martin Johnson's In Transit. So Martin Johnson was a contemporary of Chris Edwards. So Johnson argues, I'm not clear exactly what poetry is meant to do. A game of chess is an intensely dynamic, intensely kinetic object within a static set of parameters, a fixed set of rules. The same, I think, in a much more complicated way, applies to the way language works in poetry. So In Transit attempts to explore the poem as kinetic object through the static sonnet conventions of 14 lines. And made up of 14 sonnets, it's conspicuously subtitled a sonnet square rather than a sequence or series, drawing attention to space alongside time. And he does give it a specific date and location coordinates, Sydney, Athens, Sydney, 1979 to 1980. So in terms of form, his In Transit sonnets stick less to sonnet conventions than his five-poem sequence titled Uncertain Sonnets, which at least kept to or inversed a Petrarchan rhyme scheme. Instead, the sonnets In Transit merely keep to the bare bones of 14 lines of the sonnet in the way that New York School writers like Frank O'Hara, Ted Berrigan or Bernadette Mayer did when experimenting with the sonnet form. In taking 14 sonnets of 14 lines each, Johnston is working with a kind of 14 to the power of 2, even though spatially it's troublesome to make a square out of 14. So there's something there as much about the sort of mathematics of it, the equation of it, rather than it being, sort of concrete conceptual poem. And he's also experimenting with the poem as a kind of public square as much as a private cell. There is a system in and of itself as much as something which takes part in civic life. And he also signals different forms of games that are square, such as the crossword, the chessboard, the jigsaw, and origami. Now, In Transit was written as a distraction from writing a biography of his parents, for which he'd been given Australia Council funding, his parents being the writers George Johnston and Charmian Clift. And this biography was non-existent except in an abstract sense, and affectionately nicknamed Hetty by Johnston. And I thought that was interesting in light of Forbes, who was a close friend of his, and his Foreheads poem, which Sam will be talking about tomorrow. And I think it's interesting calling this non-existent biography, except in its sort of conceptual way, Hetty, in the sense of adding a Y to the proper name. So like Jonesy, Hetty. And also as referring to the life of the mind or the head, as well as passion or emotion, the heart, Hetty. So while Martin would explore and play with the relationship between writing and history in the poem, it was actually Nadia Wheatley, his partner before Roseanne Bonney, who would complete the biography of Clift. So for Johnston, the poem becomes an act of pastime, rather than what we would recognise as a narrative of past time. However, he's perhaps suggesting that we might hold both in our heads when reading In Transit. The pastime is an activity that is too trivial to be historicised, is of the everyday. It doesn't actually square up to or want to be squared with biography. And so too might be the case for poetry. And I think what Johnson is doing is exploring that relationship between the two. The title In Transit calls attention to being in time, as well as being between cultures, as belonging neither fully to one place or the other. Spending much of his life between Australia and Greece, Johnston questions the role of Australian culture in the making of self, signalled by the line, "Out of our quarrels with ourselves, we make poetry." And his personal history is contextualised through a larger lens or backdrop that's mentioned quite briefly, such as in Our Quarrels with Canberra. With the poem as in-between state, In Transit is a thinking about history as much as it's a thinking about poetry, and perhaps more fully what it is to live poetically. For Johnston, Greece is a major origin of understandings of the self and of creativity and the origins of the Western poetic tradition. He questions the affect associated with being a historical creature and the 20th century renderings of Weltschmerz or world weariness, that the physical reality can never satisfy the demands of the mind. And so the role of emotion in being historical is also something that's being tested. And Johnston explores authenticity of history through affect. There are references in Transit to simulation and falsity, feigned unanthropomorphic shyness, fake Pythagorean claritas. The honest poem, Johnston said, would be mainly white space to denote all the hours of just smoking and staring at crosswords. Rather than white space, In Transit includes mundane moments from that period of 1979 to 80, such as friends visiting, getting pissed, talking for too long, showers that don't work properly, galleries visited. Yet it also explores art as a cabinet of history and the idea of fabricated history, the latter in light of Borges' Ficciones, like Tlon Akbar, and the power of the imagination to create worlds, the infinite possibility of worlds, and even the existence of anti-worlds. So In Transit is a poem of its time in light of its recognition of the dynamic between the inward creating the outer world, that's the Borgesian metafiction, as much as the social informing the text, the outer, informing what's going on in the text, which is a bit that notion a bit of that recursive looping. And I think one of the things that attracted me to sort of selecting In Transit as a case study is that I think Johnston's interested in how different ideas of history might coincide within the one text, and the poem becoming a testing site of these different versions, and how prosody might develop in light of other cultures' sense of a historical moment, or perhaps their sense of transhistoricity. So on the one hand, he viewed Greek culture as being generated from a continuous history, arguing the much belaboured ideal of organic or natural culture, so torn and trampled and squabbled over in England and America, is far more than an ideal in Greece. Figures like Theophilus, Macrianus, etc. are linked to one another and to their heritage by a folk culture which has always expressed itself above all in song, and that these create a collective epic reverberating with a common ground note too deep for notions of influence or individuality. And he adds, for Greek culture, the high, as much as the folk, has always been rather like Freud's imaginary Rome, with all its aspects and epochs present simultaneously. Old gods are dressed up as new saints and seem quite comfortable in their unaccustomed halos. Moreover, Johnston suggests that these tricks time play in Greece make up a texture of a life. So they're very much about how one lives as much as that sense of history. So Greek culture is an uninterrupted tradition, perhaps transhistorical. And moreover, poetry has no special or transcendent role in this. It's an object that is simply made for the occasion, as with any other created object. And he notes that the 19th century General Macrianus viewed the making of a song for a dead friend in the same way as he might make that friend a coffee or, after his death, a coffin. Making him a song was an act of the same order, with no special cachet attached to the making itself. And he actually looks at these figures like Theophilus and Macrianus within the poem In Transit. So that's one version of history. At the other time, other sort of simultaneously, he realises that prosody exists and gains life by particular epochs. And he notes that the flowering of Marlowe, Shakespeare and Donne depended on a tremendous resurgent vitality of English at all levels. And in contemporary Greece, he felt that it was the historical situation of the junta that provided a universal cause. That is, it's one of the elements, among others, that saw a resurgence of vitality in the poetry. So he's dealing with these two different ideas. 1979, when Johnston was writing In Transit, would see the publication of Tranter's anthology, The New Australian Poetry, which audaciously declared a new epoch in Australian poetry. Although Johnston was a close friend of Tranter's, he seemed sceptical of this identification. And just going... The final sonnet of In Transit is titled On Aggression, Group Self-Portrait as Greyleg Goslings. And it's dedicated to Laurie Duggan, John Forbes, Gig Ryan, Tranter and Johnston himself. Any generational emergence is figured as a waddle rather than flight, and probably particularly after an afternoon of drinking together. Moreover, Johnston draws attention to the way goslings in fight. But in characterising his contemporaries as grey-leg gosling, Johnston recalls Conrad Lorenz's 1935 experiment, where one group of hatchlings saw their actual mother and followed her around, whereas the second batch had Lorenz as the first figure they saw and formed an imprint or picture of him as the object they were to follow. So this is a suggestion that history is something we receive at a particular time and follow, that there's no true mother. And so this is perhaps a third version of history that he's playing with. His final phrase, make love, not imprintings, plays on the anti-Vietnam free love phrase, make love, not war. Drawing on the war motif, Johnston raises the figure of Emperor Julian Apostate as the last Christian ruler of the Roman Empire. The youth of new Australian poetry meet in a ruined beer garden, at once proverbially Australian in the beer garden, but also with a sense of ready-made ruins prefigured. That is, there's a sense of cycles of history, the found or foundational birth of a new Australian poetry, perhaps a little bird brain, to pardon the pun. And Johnston himself really enjoyed that linguistic slippage, suggesting that that associational thinking is productive. And so there's elsewhere in the poem a shift between the Stoic and the Stoa, an attitude and a place. So Johnston's sonnets work through interrelated conceptions of creation or making, cognition and recognition and reading, so that the reading side. In Transit is also grounded in a resurgent vitality in his personal life with his new relationship with criminologist Roseanne Bonney. While In Transit begins and ends with references to Australia, to Canberra, Darlinghurst and friends, its middle focuses on Greece. And that's formally tracked by those coordinates of Johnston's own trip from Australia to Greece and back again. The first sonnet is titled Duenda in Darlinghurst. And calls upon the term duenda of spontaneous creation and also its blueness and darkness. As a physical and emotional sensation, Johnston perhaps uses it to argue in favour of A.E. Housman's test of true poetry as that which makes the hair stand on end. Localised in the Sydney suburb Darlinghurst, where Johnston lived with Bonney, the first sonnet acknowledges inhabiting Australian culture with its vernacular that populates it with larrikins, tarts and hoons. Yet this is upset by a cat from another poem, perhaps Christopher Smart's Geoffrey. Johnston, recalling Smart's poem Jubilata Agno, which was written as a pastime in a time of constraint. And there's this vague possible reference to smart raises the dynamic between creativity and control. And much, it's an example of the kind of cryptic references for the reader in transit. What's the significance of the cat? And so on the one hand, there's this playing around with the duenda, but then that's disrupted by this sort of sudden appearance of the cat. Now, Johnston notes that he's not making his poems too obscure to the reader, that there are enough references within them to follow up, to draw meaning, that the reader is intended to follow the cat and to follow Johnston through this thinking of through history and making of self or the making of poem, and that there is probably going to be further clues relating to that later on in the poem. So if we move to the second poem as an example of that, it looks at the indistinction between human, animal. Human, animal and plant, which is developed throughout the poem. And the second sonnet moves now to the island Hydra. Entitled Biography, it references Empedocles, an ancient Greek philosopher who recorded all his ideas in verse and who saw the history of the universe as tied up with the origin and development of life. And Empedocles saw the four classical elements, earth, water, air and fire, as being sent spinning through love and strife, making up a cosmic cycle. Love and strife are the mobile powers that mix and separate the four elements of what Empedocles calls roots. So humans, animals and plants all exist on the same plane, initially in fragments, but and then strange combinations, such that it's all tentative. There may be a double sex, horns without heads. And Johnston opens with a revision of the first line of Auden's elegy, Musée des Beaux-Arts, replacing about suffering, they were never wrong, with about love and hate and boredom, they were equally barracudas. Love and hate and boredom become equivalent affects to each other and perhaps to suffering. The enjamming of barracudas makes it slightly distanced from the affects. And again, there's this, so the trying to work out what the dangerous fish reference might mean. And there's this sense of, on the one hand, he's playing around with the idea of Hydra as a place of transformation, but perhaps also to Auden's quote, that a man trying to save himself from drowning is an intellectual because he's thinking about his condition. And I think he's always shifting between that thinking about and feeling about the sort of historical being. He references Hydra's transformation from one of the most primitive of places in Greece to one of the most foreign and trendy in the phrase, sold houses in lost domains. Plants and humans are viewed from the same family through the metaphor of the garden, with naked pink tendrils having so much sexual implications that Hydra or the poetic environment could even support a Jungian sandlot therapist. And again, he didn't know what a Jungian sandlot therapist was, but it sounded like something that contemporary Hydra might be able to support. And I think there's also a reference there, again, to the idea of working back through to the infantile life and if there's the potential role, or if any, to the mother and father. I might be running out of time. I'll just go through one more section. The title of the third section references Edmund Wilson's band Memoirs of Hecate Country, and suggests that history might also cover the terrain of pharmaceutical heightening or distortion of experience, sexual adventure and evening lands that refuse to focus. Wilson, of course, explored the design of history, particularly in his volume on the Russian Revolution, to the Finland Station, which he subtitled A Study in the Writing and Acting of History. Now, whereas Wilson wanted to read the Russian Revolution as a fundamental breakthrough in history, where nothing could be the same again, he began to realise that history could only be an account of what the revolutionaries thought they were doing in the interests of a better world, which Johnson suggests could be framed as whether it was good for you too, darling. So I know this does suggest that, the sort of long sweep, but I do think there is so many engagements with different theses on history in transit that it's not too long a bow. Johnston's interested in Wilson's underground or personal history of sexual adventure in his memoirs, putting together the amyl nitrate of party poppers with Wilson painting his tongue with silver nitrate to cure STD. And that idea that one paints one's tongue, and of course he's very interested in the idea of painting. And this plays around again whether one is more at home in the abstract to also chemically induced experiences of reality, of the making of that that real versus just reading about someone else who does it. And there's also, in some respects, an ongoing recognition of the inability of medical explanations throughout the poem as a kind of as being capable of covering, as being evidence, historical evidence, I suppose, for why things are as they are. The last thing I would want to put up, and this is, again, it's only the start of it. There's a whole heap in the middle which does focus on the role of art, particularly painting and history. And the examples that that have been kept in galleries and museums, like Rout of San Romano, versus the work of Theophilus that was often on village shops' walls and that peeled and disintegrated. And both were kind of as detailed and excessive as each other. But the Rout of San Romano is one which clearly depicts and is inevitably showing, it shows history as inevitably in the hands of the winners. And this is something that Johnston critiques through the focus on the decorative and on satire, and reading the two figures at the back left of the painting as two knights who are wandering out the back of the canvas and not giving a stuff who wins. And that notion of using that specifically Australian vernacular, not giving a stuff who wins, and a very sort of cynical contemporary approach to it is in some ways, again, makes him sort of exemplary of that 1980s moment, an Australian sort of generation of 68. But I would say that, in fact, he's both exemplary, but he's not exemplary because of this relationship to Greek poetry. And that while he's doing all this kind of dense, obscure playing around with the texture of the poem and with ideas of thinking about making and reading, he's also translating both contemporary and old Greek poems and reading them to audiences of Greeks in Australia who are basically overcome with tears. And for him, that's the place where real poetry is. And again, that's something which that performance is not able to be, wasn't recorded. It's not part of the history that we have. So it's much more difficult to talk, like to actually then analyse as sort of, it's the absence, it's the white space, if you like. Okay, thanks.